Good morning, everyone. It's great to be in Northern California again. I started my aviation career up at NASA Ames a long time ago, way longer than I'd like to admit, and so it's always great to be back out here. I am the only person in the audience, I think, other than my colleague from the FAA wearing a suit, and it reminds me of those days when I was in college when I owned a suit, and the only thing I used it for were weddings and funerals. And now I've become one. So, you know, the suit from Washington is here to hopefully give you a little information today. My theme of my discussion is, what have we done for you lately? The FAA is doing everything we can to enable unmanned aircraft operations in the national airspace system. So I have spoken to several folks this morning who are public aircraft operators who still want to get into the air and fly. We've been doing that for a very long time through our process known as the Certificate of Authorization process. That's still out there, still available. It's gotten to be, I won't go so far as to say routine, but it's fairly well understood. And we have a lot of people taking advantage of over 700 public aircraft operations. Now, public, for those of you not steeped in federal regulations, means government, so government operators. And that's significant because the government operators have the authority to approve their own pilots and their own aircraft, so it was easier for them to move forward. From a civil aircraft operations, which is, you know, what most people want to talk about, we've now got a couple of ways for people to move forward into that area. I'll talk to you about that in detail. And then I'll end with a little bit of information about what we're doing about the model aircraft operators, or the new breed of model aircraft operators. So Section 333, it refers to the FAA's authorization of 2012. Now, I'll give you a little quick civics lesson. Every federal agency has two bills that govern what they do. The first one is their authorization, which basically creates the agency or the organization within the federal government, allows them to operate, and Congress tells us exactly what we are and are not allowed to do. Those authorizations typically come up to every 3 to 5 years, and Congress tells us what to do. DOD actually gets authorized every year, believe it or not. But the other bill that's really important that most people hear about is appropriations. That's where they give us money to tell us what we can really do or not. But the authorization bill governs very tightly what a federal agency is allowed to do. Previous to 2012, there were three requirements in the legislation that every aircraft operated for civil purposes had to meet. First, it had to be registered, had to have an N number, and that applies to government operations as well, other than DOD, who's got their own registration system. Second, every civil aircraft had to be operated by a certificated pilot, what we colloquially referred to as a licensed pilot. And then third, and what was the biggest barrier for small unmanned aircraft, was they had to have an airworthiness certificate. Now, Section 333 allowed us to exempt people from that requirement, which really opened up small unmanned aircraft operations for civil purposes. So as you can see here, it obviously makes a lot more sense for this little quadcopter to be doing this inspection versus the poor guys in the fire suits trying to do the same thing. And these are the types of operations that people are out there getting approval to do today. Now, you may wonder why it took us so long to get this up and running. Well, the process by which we do exemptions to the rules is a regulatory process. And the regulatory process, in this case, was designed to deal with exceptions. It's not designed to be an approval process. So we've sort of been bending it to that use. And we think we've got it sorted out now, because as of today, I got word we're over 260 authorized operators, which you can see some of here. But the number of applications is now topped 1,100. So, you know, obviously the demand is there, and we think we've figured out a way forward to meet that demand. The interest, as I said, has just been overwhelming. You see this says 1,000, it's already over 1,100. It's almost impossible to keep these charts up to date. But the important one is on the bottom. Over the last month, we've done a tremendous number, and we think we've got the process figured out where we can comply with the rules around exemptions and still issue these approvals. They are very limited because one of the key safety factors that we use for every civil aircraft operation is that you have to have some level of confidence that the aircraft is going to do what it's supposed to do and not create an unsafe condition. We've waived that. So that means that we put no credence whatsoever on the aircraft. We're essentially saying we're going to figure out a way to allow this aircraft to operate even though it could fall from the sky at any time, it could veer off and do crazy things. So the only way to do that is to limit the area of operation, limit the way you operate, where you operate, et cetera. And that's what we've done. If you want to see the specifics, they're all on our website. I urge you to go take a look there. There's also detailed instructions about how to go about becoming a Section 333 operator. It doesn't require you to hire some high-priced lawyer to help you through the process. We believe that any citizen should have the ability to get through this process without having to spend a lot of money to do it. If you have specific questions, here is an email address. You can send us your questions about the process, but please take a look at our website first. There is a whole bunch of how-to information there that should help you understand your responsibilities as an operator under this exemption process. The exemption process is really intended to be a bridge to where we want to be, which is spelled out in our rule that we announced a couple of months ago, and the comment period closed just last week. Now, this rule deals with the legislative requirements and takes advantage of the authority to not require airworthiness for certain types of unmanned aircraft. So what we've done with this rule is to try to tackle the lowest risk operations that we have going on or people want to conduct. Again, by not putting any requirements on the aircraft, we've put all of the burden on the pilot and limited the area of operation. So hopefully those of you who are interested have commented. The comment period has closed now. We've got, I believe, pushing 7,000 comments that'll have to be resolved before we can move forward. It does create a new type of pilot certificate. So currently, if you're going to operate as a 333 operator, your pilot has to have one of the existing manned aircraft certificates, which the lowest bar of that is the sport pilot certificate. This rule creates a new certificate for unmanned aircraft pilots. It is designed to be an easy bar to get over. It's really focused on understanding the airspace, understanding your responsibilities as a pilot operating in the airspace. I like to say the small UAS industry is Silicon Valley meets aviation, because the folks building the small unmanned aircraft are coming out of the high-tech industries, the relatively unregulated, but yet they're taking their technology and putting it into one of the most regulated situations in the United States, which is the national airspace. So again, you must follow the operating limitations in order to operate safely, because we're not putting any dependence on the aircraft. Oops. One of the precepts is that you can't operate over non-participants. And so you look at the picture down here and you go, hey, that little guy's flying over the football players. Well, those football players are participants in that practice, and the aircraft is filming the practice, so therefore that is allowed. Now, you couldn't be flying over the fans on the sidelines watching the practice, but it's okay to fly over the participants. So again, the idea is to try to keep people on the ground safe and avoid any conflicts with aircraft in the air. Now, on that subject, we all know that there have been a lot of reports of unmanned aircraft operating where they shouldn't be. We're assuming these are model aircraft folks who don't really understand the rules. I like to use this picture because the guys in the upper picture are not a problem. The FAA has been working with the model aircraft community for decades without any safety issues being created between their type of flying and manned aviation flying. But what's happened since the advent of the quadcopter is now all of a sudden, instead of having to have intimate aviation knowledge in order to fly a remote control aircraft, all of a sudden, right out of the box, you're now an aviator. The aircraft essentially flies itself. A lot of these aircraft can go very high. They can operate pretty much anywhere you want them to operate. And the folks operating them, and most importantly, I think, the folks operating them don't really understand that they're entering the aviation system. They don't understand that they have responsibilities as an operator in that system. When you went out and you bought a kit and you built it, if you didn't go somewhere where there were people to help you learn how to fly it, your first flight was also your last, because you'd crash. They're really not that easy to fly. Not so with these that you can order over the internet. So what are we doing about it? Well, the first thing the FAA did last summer, we put out essentially a document written by lawyers, mostly for lawyers, but nonetheless, it was a legal document that said, hey, here's how the existing rules apply to model aircraft operators. We put it out for comment because we wanted to make sure that we got it right. We got a lot of comments. And so consequently, we're sort of reconsidering some of the way we've interpreted the rules. But this was our first attempt to say, look, some of the FAA's rules apply even though you're a model aircraft. And that basically means don't put manned aviation at risk. Don't put people on the ground at risk. But obviously nobody in general reads the Federal Register, so this wasn't really sufficient. And we want to focus on education. The key to safe operations is having people understand the rules, why the rules are there, and how they affect everybody who operates in the national airspace system. So we put out a notice to our aviation safety inspectors. These are the guys who work in local facilities we call flight standards district offices all around the country. They're the first responders, if you will, to any aviation issues. We put out to them the notice that says, hey, we want you to educate people first and foremost. It's about compliance, not enforcement. So the first step is always education. We gave them a letter to send to operators to say, hey, look, here are the rules, please follow them. And only as a last resort do we go to, when somebody's really egregiously violating the rules, being unsafe, then we go to enforcement. We also put out guidance on how to do said enforcement, what criteria you would use to go forward to do that. Now, just as an example, whoops, wrong button. As an example, we've got about 200 cases that we've investigated, and out of that total 200, only 9 of them actually resulted in a recommendation for a civil penalty to the operator. So you can see that, you know, we really don't want to be doing enforcement. We want to be helping people to comply voluntarily, because 99% of all people don't want to do anything unsafe. They don't want to put anybody else at risk. So the bottom line, and I'll close with the fact that I want you to understand that the small rule isn't the end state. The small rule is just the first step of many to truly integrate unmanned aircraft in the national airspace system. Next week at AUVSI, we're going to be announcing some of our next steps that we're moving forward to help bring this industry forward and to regulate it in a way that's safe, but also enables everyone to operate in the system. So next week, the announcements are actually going to occur on the 6th, so stay tuned for more next week. And with that, I have a good bit of time left for questions, so I do request that you get to the microphone so that everybody can hear the question, and I'll repeat it if you need me to.
Hello. I was just curious about your line of sight restriction and if you thought that could be changed in the future as sensors improve and give more awareness to pilots even out of line of sight.
So we have already approved the first commercial operation beyond visual line of sight. And for many years, the military, Customs and Border, and other federal agencies have been operating aircraft beyond line of sight. The big issue with line of sight is the ability to see and avoid other aircraft. So if you can see your aircraft, you can see other aircraft and you can get out of their way, because the unmanned aircraft have to give way to the manned aircraft. So sensor technology, as it develops, will eventually be able to provide an equivalent level of safety to a pilot being able to see and avoid. But that technology has yet to be certified. We're working on standards in an industry standards writing body to get to the point where we can start approving that. The DoD is on target to approve their first airborne sense and avoid systems by around 2018, they think. depending on which platform is chosen, that's targeted toward the big aircraft, you know, the Predators, the Reapers, the Global Hawks. I do believe there is a whole bunch of technology that's being developed, both ground and airborne, that will enable beyond visual line of sight. Currently, we enable it either through procedural separation. We have approved the Scan Eagle to fly off the coast of Alaska to support the oil and gas exploration up there. And we have a procedural separation method where if you're going to fly a manned aircraft into this area that's charted, then you call up a number and they'll coordinate with the flight services folks up in Alaska, coordinate with the unmanned aircraft operators to make sure they're out of the way of the manned aircraft operation. Obviously, that only works in the remotest of areas and wouldn't really be feasible in the lower 48. But it is sort of that next step. We understand that there's a lot of value in flying beyond visual line of sight, and that's one of the areas where we're looking to move ahead rapidly in the next few years.
So my quick question is in regards to education, like you were saying. I know for a fact that, like, Australia, whenever you buy a Phantom or a model that's there, they give you a pamphlet in the box saying do's and don'ts. And right. Recently I bought a Phantom 3 for a client, and the first thing I saw in the box was that, and I proved the fact that it actually is there. How much more are you going to push that to other products? Because that's the big thing, is education. Not knowing what you can and cannot do is the things that hurt the people here who follow the rules. The ones who are hurting us are the ones who don't know what the rules are and making you guys force the hand that you don't want to use.
So that's a voluntary thing that I actually worked out directly with DJI and a couple of the other vendors to include materials from a joint industry government initiative called Know Before You Fly. The pamphlet you got on the cover of it said Know Before You Fly. There's a website out there, Know Before You Fly. We're working with the Association of Unmanned Vehicle Systems International, AUVSI, who's a big conference next week. The Academy of Model Aeronautics, which is the biggest community-based organization in the U.S. for model aviation. And the Small UAV Coalition, who I met with earlier this week, we're all working together to try to promote safe unmanned aircraft operations, and we're encouraging all the manufacturers to include that material in their boxes to help with that education. There's promotional events about Know Before You Fly, and we're all working toward finding more and more ways to keep the energy up around that. So I'm glad that started at the Consumer Electronics Show. I spoke at the Consumer Electronics Show. I talked to there were 17 vendors of unmanned aircraft exhibiting at the CES this year, which was just amazing. And so I tried to talk to as many of them as possible, showed them the materials. We send them the high def PDF file, and they print it out and put it in the boxes. So thanks for bringing that up. That's a great thing.
Question about the Section 333 exemption.
Sure.
Can you use a 333 exemption to exempt the need for a pilot? That is to say, if you have autonomous routes over agriculture or the like Skycatch or things of that nature?
The answer is no. Again, back to the civics lesson. The FAA's authorizing legislation requires every civil aircraft to be operated by a certificated airman. And so that means that if it's in the legislation, we can't give exemptions to it. Yes, it's in the regulations, but the regulations are driven by the legislation. So unless Congress changes that law, you're always going to have a certificated pilot flying or responsible for the flight of the aircraft. Now, responsible means that they can intervene in the flight. The aircraft may be doing its thing, and all they're doing is monitoring. They don't actually have to be controlling it at all times.
And so if the only action is returned home, if the only action that can be transacted is to return to home, why do you need a pilot to hit the button that says return to home?
It's the law. Ultimately, it's the law. And bottom line is, it's a good law because somebody has to be responsible for the operation of that aircraft. You know, if there is something that's done incorrectly, improperly, unsafely, somebody's got to be held accountable for that, and that's the pilot in command. Now, the new certificate that we're creating in the Part 107 is doesn't require any practical training skills to operate the aircraft. It just requires knowledge of the airspace and those responsibilities that we expect you to fulfill as the FAA. So that's why we've created that new certificate. He's asking when will the rule be complete? Typically, once the comment period closes, there's a 16-month period that elapses between when the rule is when the comment period closes and when the rule becomes final. So we're doing everything we can to beat that time frame, but 16 months is the normal time elapsed. So that's 16 months from last week is when the earliest that it, well, not the earliest, but when the normal time frame is. It is the FAA's highest priority to get this rule done as quickly as possible, and that goes all the way to the FAA Administrator and the Secretary of Transportation. So we're going to do everything we can to beat that 16-month time frame.
Hello. I have one question right here. You said you're going to be issuing these new UAS certificates. How are you going to go about finding pilot examiners to issue those certificates? Mm-hmm. And is there a process for people like me who are a private pilot and have been flying model aircraft for 10 plus years to be able to become a DP to issue these certificates?
So we haven't gone into the details yet about what sort of credit you're going to get for being a private pilot as far as getting your unmanned certificate. But the way you go about getting your unmanned aircraft operator certificate is through the testing center. So when you got your private pilot's certificate, you went to a testing center and got your ground school certification. It'll be just like that. There won't be any requirement to find a pilot examiner because there's no practical testing requirements. Now, this is all assuming that the rule doesn't change between the proposed rule and the final rule. But as written, all you would have to do is go to one of those testing centers, you know, present your passing grade on the exam to the FAA, and we'll issue your certificate as an unmanned aircraft operator. Over here.
What benchmarks would you like to be seen set by public agencies? What benchmarks would you like to be seen set by public agencies? Do you have examples? I know the Mariposa County Sheriff's Department had done a lot of work that I've been able to view. Are there benchmarks or things you would like to see from public agencies?
So we've been working with public agencies. He is asking about what benchmarks are we looking for from public agencies. We've been working with public agencies for 8-10 years now about how they operate unmanned aircraft. And all of them have been required to give us feedback on their operations, what kind of mishaps they've had, why they happened, et cetera. And all of that data has gone into a database that we use to advise us on writing the rules that you've seen. So that process has been ongoing for a very long time and will continue to go on. And we've learned a lot from our public aircraft operators that we're carrying into the, for example, a lot of the larger federal agencies have testing requirements for their flight crews. They've shared those with us, and that is contributing to the testing standards that we'll have out to get that unmanned aircraft pilot certificate that I was talking about earlier.
All right. Hi there. I'm a researcher here at UC Santa Cruz, and I know a lot of scientists are starting to use drones to collect their data for them. And mm-hmm. I was wondering, you know, there seems to be confusion in the community about where we exist in the space of commercial to recreational use of drones, and what set of proposed rules or current rules sort of the scientific community falls under.
So we tried to explain that in the interpretive rule. What you got to understand is what one of the other provisions of our 2012 reauthorization was Section 336. And 336 carved out a niche for the hobby and recreational flyers. The language in there is very specific. It says this only applies to hobby and recreational use only. So education had traditionally sort of operated in that same method and essentially following the same rules as the hobbyists did. But the law actually changed that. The law, it's not about whether it's commercial or not, it's about whether it's hobby or recreation or not. And obviously a university research isn't hobby or recreation, it's pursuant to a larger goal of research. So consequently, we've been advising public universities to use our public authorization process under the COA process and private universities to get Section 333 approvals to cover them to be completely following the rules completely. So yeah, that's the current situation. Over here.
Hey, Jim, if one of your primary concerns is separation, and you already have a construct in the federal system right now for IFR flight under mm-hmm. positive control, why couldn't you just issue IFR clearances for aircraft departing from the ground, complete positive control, separation via radar through the IFR mm-hmm. system? Why wouldn't you be able to do that?
We do that. For Customs and Border and the DOD who fly high up and away, they file IFR flight plans and they follow them. Now, what you've got to understand is that unless you're operating in restricted airspace, there are non-participants who may not be, especially in Class E below 10,000, there are a lot of VFR aircraft operations that are not in contact with air traffic and that are not under positive control or
yes,
under
but
VFR
IFR operations can occur in VFR conditions. I mean, you can, in other words, I mean, we launch IFR aircraft all the time mm-hmm. from the ground right up through VFR conditions, and sometimes they're never even in a cloud. They're just not responsible
right.
for their own separation, the agency is.
Well, as soon as you get beyond visual line of sight, though, you now, as the operator, don't have any way to see and avoid the other aircraft in Class E. And there are lots of non-participants, balloons, gliders, airships, et cetera, who don't even have transponders. There's a whole community of aircraft out there that don't have electrical systems.
Okay, Jim, if they were in IMC conditions from zero to zero, from takeoff to landing, and the agency was responsible for their separation,
right,
then they wouldn't be able to see and avoid a balloon anyways in IMC.
Right, in IMC, but in VMC, you still have a responsibility, even if you're under an IFR clearance, to see and avoid those non-participants. And that's really the big barrier. So the way Customs and Border, DOD does it is they chase that airplane until it gets into IFR airspace, and then they're up and away, and we do it exactly what you say. But it's just that gap between the terminal controlled airspace and the high altitude en route airspace that you have to have some means to see and avoid the other aircraft. Now, DOD is building a ground-based detect and avoid system that'll allow them to cover that gap based on radar information from the ground. Obviously, that's, you know, it's only going to be available to the DOD folks, but I think that shows a lot of promise for achieving exactly what you're talking about.
Okay, so weather conditions was part of the risk assessment. So what are the thoughts on how they should be checked specifically and maybe even documented if there's a safety incident?
So weather conditions, every pilot, manned aircraft pilot today is responsible for getting a weather briefing prior to flight. There's a system out there that makes that available through a collaboration between the National Weather Service and the FAA. You get it through our flight service process. We expect our unmanned aircraft operators to follow those same procedures using those same systems. There's really no need to create anything special for unmanned aircraft when that system already exists for all operators in the national airspace.
To be slightly repetitive, I work with a bunch of people who are very high quality aerial thermographers, mm-hmm. and they believe that the state of drone technology has reached the point where they could do some of their work with drones. Mm-hmm. And very specifically, if I wanted to do a survey of this building at midnight, mm-hmm. using a drone, currently that's not legal, I understand.
Not true. If you get a Section 333 approval, you can, and then you get approval to operate in this airspace, you could do it tomorrow. You could, I know several companies you could hire to do exactly that tomorrow. So it does exist, and there is a legal way forward to do that. Now that we have that exemption process set up and running, and there's 260 plus operators out there approved to go do that today.
Okay, because they know about that form and they didn't see a way of doing it, but we'll check again.
Well, it's relatively new, so you know that we only really started doing this last fall, as they've been around a year yet. So
they know about it.
Okay.
Thank you, everybody. Thank you so much. We've really got to go. I'm really sorry, Jim. Thank you so much. As a little token of our appreciation.
Oh, thank you.
And thanks so much.